Welcome to A Cult of Personality podcast. Joining us today is a very special guest. We have with us Angel Millar. Angel is a researcher, Masonic scholar, and writer. His first book, entitled Freemasonry, A History, was published in 2005. And he has a new book coming out soon entitled Forest of Symbols, Freemasonry and the Western Esoteric Tradition, which will be published by Ouroboros Press. Again, it's coming out very soon. Angel, thanks and for joining us and welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you.
Really appreciate you taking the time to join us. Today we wanted to talk primarily about Freemasonry in a historical sense, as well as Masonic Rosicrucianism. So I guess to get started, if you wouldn't mind talking briefly about the origins of Freemasonry and the fraternity as your research has uncovered.
Well, okay, usually the official date for the beginning of Freemasonry is 1717, when the first Grand Lodge was founded. But there were already several other lodges in existence at that point that came together, so it clearly has a history going back further than that. And in fact, it can be traced back into the medieval period through the stonemasons and several different mythologies which were recorded by the stonemasons, which were later incorporated into the Masonic rituals, go back several hundred years before that into the late 14th century.
Okay, because when going through the material to research this question, I think people encounter all of these different concepts about the Knights Templar and the Crusades and chivalric orders, the stonemasons in the medieval period, as you mentioned, and then the little slightly more esoteric theories about the Invisible College and the group surrounding Francis Bacon.
Right. And and Freemasonry is a very complicated subject indeed. And it's probably no easy way to explain it, but essentially the first three degrees, which constitute craft Freemasonry, which if you're in America or England or another English-speaking country, craft Freemasonry, entered apprentice, fellow craft, and master mason, that constitutes Freemasonry proper. And there are other so-called higher degrees, which are really not considered to be higher, but are considered to be additional. However, if you are in France, those higher degrees really are considered to be more important. And in there, you discover all sorts of mythologies of the Knights Templar, alchemy, Rosicrucianism, and some things which are maybe a little less interesting, but all of that is certainly there. Historically, some people do think that Freemasonry came from the Knights Templar. Most scholars, if not all scholars in this day and age, think that it did not come from the Knights Templar. But certainly this idea of knighthood, and in particular the Templars, did feed into Freemasonry, especially the higher degrees. And there is today even a Knights Templar Masonic degree, which is the highest degree in New York, right? It's the 10th degree or 13th, depending on how you look at it. There are three additional degrees there as well.
All right. Well, I guess for people listening, I think most are probably familiar with Freemasonry and the fraternity. Would you mind giving sort of a high-level overview description of sort of the nature and purpose of Freemasonry as you understand it, for people
right.
that are not familiar?
Sure. Well, taking the three degrees of craft Freemasonry, it teaches morals, mythology, based in part on the stonemasons, the mythology part, there's biblical mythology, and such as Solomon's Temple, Originally, those degrees were Christian, but they were later de-Christianized, although the Bible is still placed on an altar generally. And apart from that, there seems to have been, they seem to have derived quite a bit from English philosophy, and probably philosophy actually going back to the ancient Greek. So it was sort of a way of initiating mostly young men into manhood and imparting to them certain moral ideas and ways of behaving as a man. Going into the higher degrees, such as the Knights Templar or the Rose Croix, there certainly are ideas of alchemy in the Rose Croix, for example, and Christian chivalry in there. And in another degree, the Knight of the Sun, that's almost entirely just teaching of basic alchemical procedures and symbols.
And that's the 28th degree? Scottish Rite?
It is, yes.
Okay.
It's actually taken different places. Most of the degrees have been moved around, and they came from a rite of 25 degrees originally, and then it was expanded to 33, so it would have had a different place at one point.
Okay. Interesting. Would you say that there's validity then in the idea that Freemasonry is a more modern manifestation of the ancient mystery schools in a what we would consider a very socially acceptable form?
Well, that's certainly an idea that's very popular in Freemasonry, and especially if you read books by Masonic scholars 100 or 200 years ago, that was definitely the prevailing idea.
Mm-hmm.
And you probably know that the prevailing idea now is that it's a social club, but certainly a lot of Freemasons are resistant to that idea and definitely hold it to be a mystery school. And I think that's broadly accurate, although I would definitely say that one should factor in things like the fact that they did derive things from irrational philosophy as well, and also from the Christian religion as well. But certainly I think it effectively is a kind of mystery school, yes.
And I guess for people who the two ideas seem diametrically opposed, as a mystery school and a social club, I think I'm wondering, you know, from your experience, is it possible to be both, in that the mysteries are there for people who want to explore them and for people who just want to, you know, experience the sort of more social aspects, they can simply engage that part of it more?
Yeah, that's a great and complicated question, or necessitates a complicated answer, maybe. I think it's definitely true. If you were to go to a lodge, or if you were to explore Freemasonry in the English-speaking world today, and perhaps especially America, then you would find that many Masons are really just interested in the social side, although I have to say the vast majority of Freemasons I have met are interested in the symbols and mystery of Freemasonry. So I wouldn't negate that in any way. But yeah, certainly some Masons are really much more interested in the social side of having dinner and talking about whatever they want to talk about, whereas some other Masons are deeply involved in different types of mysticism and explore Freemasonry as a sort of mystical practice or mystery school, very definitely. And that's today's manifestation. And probably if you look at the American Freemasonry, that's really spelled out in its degree structure now, where you can quite easily end up as a Masonic Rosicrucian on the one hand, or on the other hand, you could end up as a Shriner, where there really isn't anything mystical whatsoever. If you go back to the original Freemasonry, or at least Freemasonry in the early 18th century, and probably before that, it was much more the same thing. that the early Masonic ritual, the oldest Masonic ritual, was given either after dinner or in many cases actually during dinner. So a Bible and the three candles and the square and compasses, etc., would all be laid out next to jugs of beer and things like this, and it would take place literally during dinner. So the social side and the mystery side actually was pretty much the same thing. But then, of course, some Masonic scholars would compare that to the early Christian meal, for example, which was also social, but obviously mystical and religious at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, this was called Table Lodge, is that right?
Oh, that's right, that's right. Well, the Table Lodge actually does still exist, although most lodges don't put it on. So that's a sort of modern term for it today, where you can still find it. Which is not that often, but yeah, actually the original Masonic ritual was given a table, or it was essentially a table lodge, that's right. And there would be lots of drinking and toasting, and but at the same time a serious, sober Masonic ritual was going on as well. So.
So you can definitely see the combination of the two, at least in the beginnings, for sure.
Definitely, definitely. It was one and the same thing, absolutely. And if you actually read a lot of very old Masonic books from more than 100 years ago, you find that there is, in some cases, quite an obsession about the eating habits of old mystery schools such as the Essenes or the early Christians, and that really is emphasized in some Masonic histories, believe it or not.
Interesting, yeah. And this idea is definitely very prevalent both in, you know, pre-Christian and early Christian sects, I guess you could say.
Right, right. And then if you look at, for example, as going forward, then if you look at the Knights Templar degree in Masonry, you also find that the initiate has to drink a glass of wine, and essentially it is sort of based on the early Masonic ritual. There is a kind of toast given, although it's much more sober and it's a much more somber environment. But then obviously if you look at the Golden Dawn, or even the magic of Aleister Crowley, there's also a Eucharistic element as well, so mm-hmm. It continues right through.
Interesting. All right. Before we get too far into the material, I wondered if you might talk a little bit about sort of what it was about the Western esoteric tradition, Freemasonry and Rosicrucianism, and these ideas that interested you and have caused you to really pursue it and write your books and do this work.
Right. Well, I got interested in esotericism, it must be probably about 2 decades ago, maybe even slightly more than 2 decades. So I can't entirely remember what prompted me to that, but I can say that in recent years when I've been researching Freemasonry, I think one of the most interesting things has been that Freemasonry is more ambiguous in that it definitely includes philosophy from the ancient Greeks or the rational philosophers such as John Locke or Hobbes. It also incorporates a lot of Christian symbolism and Christian religious ideas, and then obviously very mystical ideas when you look at the higher degrees such as alchemy. And it's combined in a pretty coherent way that really does sort of work together, I think, and produces something which is intelligent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, many, many people have made similar comments about that, really Freemasonry being the repository and keepers of a lot of ancient wisdom and maybe not so ancient wisdom, as you mentioned,
right.
Rational philosophy and the Enlightenment and all of that time period as well.
Yeah, and I think today with one of the downfalls of esotericism, to use that term, in the very most modern sense of the word, is that it tends to avoid rationalism, and I find this with even with some Freemasons that I speak to, but you definitely need that rational component. And I was reading through some works of Aleister Crowley in the last year or so for my researches, and in there he recommends reading Hegel's Science of Logic, among many other books. But if you go back far enough, this is definitely a component which maybe has been siphoned off over the years, unfortunately.
I would tend to agree, and I think for students of the tarot, the idea of behind the key four, the emperor, really speaks to the need for the reason and the application of the discerning faculties.
Yeah, and this is a personal observation, but I think one of the problems of esotericism, or at least people that practice esotericism, is that they don't seem to have enough confidence to look at things rationally, to believe that there actually may be something much more valuable there than they already have. It's too easy to compare one symbol to another and come up with your own foregone conclusion, whereas rationalism forces you to go beyond that and negate your own preconceptions, I think.
Oh, that's a very profound idea. It was actually, I was reading it online, it was a online version of A.E. Waite's Devil Worship in France.
Okay.
I don't know if you're familiar with that book.
Actually, I'm not, but okay. But I am familiar with Waite. So,
okay. Yeah. So that's Waite's book about the Leo Taxil affair.
Right, right, yeah.
And he talks about this concept of the anti-Masonic groups or writers interpreting words and symbols in ways that are not necessarily correct, but
right.
He did a very interesting analysis of that, I thought. But sorry to go off on a tangent.
Well, no, not at all. And I think it's actually an important point, which is rarely picked up on today. And to give a Masonic example, there's a symbol called the 47th proposition of Euclid, which is essentially the Pythagoras theorem, a rectangle to triangle, and and today, if you speak to most Masons and ask them what is it, well, the ones that have any idea at all beyond what's said in the ritual, which is it teaches you to have, I think, something like respect for the arts or something. Well, the ones that have an idea beyond that usually say it's from ancient Egypt and the building of the pyramids. Well, that really wasn't an idea that the early Masons were interested in or had any conception of. But the early Masons, many of them were actually builders, and the 47th proposition, or the right angle triangle, is used in making the first corner when you draw out a building plan on the floor, and they actually still were drawing out plans on the floor in the early Masonic ritual, which has now been dropped. So it definitely came from stonemasonry. But it's also found in the history of philosophy as well. Aristotle mentions it, and it's mentioned by Hobbes and by John Locke as well, and in different ways. That would be much more likely to have fed into it.
Okay, I don't know if you are familiar at all with Paul Foster Case's work.
A little, but not significantly.
Okay, I've talked about him in the past, and it's particularly a book that he wrote called Esoteric Keys of Alchemy.
Oh, okay.
And in this book, he talks about this right triangle. And if you just indulge me for a second, I read this. He develops the idea about the right triangle and what it corresponds to, and how it can be interpreted using what he calls ageless wisdom. And he says, let's see, many symbols refer to the idea that the first matter is one, which is also three, four, and five. Among them is the Great Pyramid, one structure representing the number three by its triangular faces, the number four by its square base, and the number five by its apex and four corners. The apron worn by Freemasons, which, when properly proportioned, contains the fundamental pyramid measures, is also a unity, representing the number three by its triangular flap, the number four by the square shape of the apron itself, and the number five by the five corners of the apron and flap combined. Yet another familiar symbol of the first matter is the celebrated Pythagorean triangle, sacred to Osiris, Isis, and Horus, having these proportions. In this triangle, the figure itself is the one representation of the all-pervading first matter. The descending vertical line of Osiris, the father, is attributed to the three principles, Mercury, Sulfur, and Salt. The horizontal line attributed to Isis, the mother, has four units represented the four elements, fire, water, air, and earth. The ascending line containing five units and representing Horus, the son of Osiris and Isis, shows the five stages in the development of life power's manifestation. The first stage is that of the mineral, then comes the plant, after the plant is the animal, above the animal is the natural man, above the natural man is the man who has made himself the subject of the great work, the man who is adept, master, and magus, the man who completes the great work by becoming one with the Father, even as the line of Horus in this triangle completes itself by arriving at the point whence the lines of Osiris descends. And he goes into a complete breakdown of this, talking about Kabbalism and the stone that the builders refused and the different correspondences and numerical values. But I think that's another sort of illustration of how you can take symbols and they can be important and have many meanings that are all valid simultaneously.
Right, definitely. And that's actually one of the interesting things about Freemasonry, in that the same symbols, or many of the same symbols that you find in the three craft degrees, are later found in the higher degrees where they're given a new interpretation. So the stone of the building work in the three degrees could end up as the philosophical stone in another degree.
Yeah, it's very fascinating.
Yeah.
And if I'm not mistaken, I think another good sort of illustration of the point you just made about the symbols having different meanings in different degrees is Morals and Dogma by Albert Pike, whereby if you look at the different chapters for different degrees, he kind of lays them out in that manner, sort of going into the different detail and the mythology surrounding the symbols.
Right, definitely. Yeah, it's a curious work, and you may know this, but it's actually a lot of it is taken from Elvis Levi as well. So.
Mm-hmm. All right, another thing I wanted to touch on is the concept of Rosicrucianism. I think most people listening are probably familiar with the idea of Rosicrucianism, the Rosicrucian fraternity. As a mystical, spiritual, possibly political, religious, philosophic school of initiates. But many people are not aware that in addition to the more well-known non-Masonic Rosicrucian groups, whether it's Amorc or what have you, there is Masonic Rosicrucian fraternities that exist within Freemasonry and are distinct and separate. Is that right?
That is correct, absolutely. And there's one Masonic Rosicrucian society which exists today, mostly in Britain and the U.S., but elsewhere, I believe in France and certainly in Canada, the Societas Rosicruciana. And but there was also the Golden Rosicrucians, membership of which was only open to Freemasons, and they existed in the 18th century and fell apart at the end of that century. But their degree structure was adopted by the Societas Rosicruciana, and from there, most likely into the Golden Dawn, and then many other Rosicrucian orders that we can think of, like Amok, I believe, has a similar system of the nine degrees.
Mm-hmm. Would Would you say that there, aside from the Masonic connection, obviously, is there any other major distinction between the Masonic and the non-Masonic Rosicrucian groups? I get the sense, and I could be completely incorrect about this, but are the Masonic Rosicrucian Society, is that more of a research and historical based group, or am I completely off base?
No, you're not off base at all. One of the primary aims for it being established was as a kind of research body, in fact, and its aim was to explicitly research Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, and related subjects. So that was its initial aim. But that said, that may not be the emphasis today. I think that the emphasis is more on the rituals, and there are definite similarities between those rituals and the Golden Dawn, but they're much simpler, and they are sort of Masonic in essence, in that they convey principles of, for example, alchemy, and give historical lectures, but like Freemasonry, they do not impart particular mystical practices such as you would find in the Golden Dawn. So it's a kind of ceremonial, ritualistic, version of alchemy, for example.
Interesting. Okay.
I suppose I should add that it is also, it would be Christian, whereas Amok is not specifically Christian, whereas the Masonic Rosicrucian Society of today is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, that's an important distinction too. Now, you brought up the Golden Dawn and the similarities in the ritual, and I think it's important to mention, as we did prior to beginning the recording, that the founders of the Golden Dawn Society, Samuel Liddell, McGregor Mathers, and Wynne Westcott, were both members of the Masonic Rosicrucian Society. In fact, and Westcott, you said, I believe, was the... the leader.
He was the Supreme Magus, which is the highest position he's essentially had, and he had the position in 1892, and Mathers held the position of a junior substitute Magus, which would be just a couple down from Westcott, like in the same year, I believe.
So obviously that had a definite impact, I think, on at least... the structure and concept of the group, and you mentioned previously, and I wanted to talk about this, is the similarity between the Golden Dawn sort of lower grade rituals and the degree rituals for Freemasonry.
Yes.
And you said that I believe that there's 11 different steps in the ritual itself, and they very much mirror one another, almost as if they... I guess what I'm trying to point out is that if they didn't take the ritual directly from their experience with Freemasonry, then it came from whatever source Freemasonry got it from. Would that be a correct assumption?
Right. I think the Golden Dawn is more eclectic. I mean, it's definitely derived quite a bit from Freemasonry and Masonic Rosicrucianism in particular. Though obviously, it also draws on medieval magic and astrology as well. Although it's kind of, I did notice in my research that actually Mathers, and I believe Westcott as well, published a couple of papers in the Societas Rosicruciana journal in England, and on subjects related to Kabbalah and various esoteric subjects.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
based on some of your brief remarks about it earlier, I'm curious about how that might be looked upon in sort of today's world. because you don't hear much in terms of Freemasonry publicizing connections with the Golden Dawn and people involved with that as much as I, you know, you hear constantly about the founding fathers in the United States. Ben Franklin is used in the commercials. It definitely seems like there's a sort of targeting, you know, who they want to portray as the associated influences.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, I think it's all well-meaning that this is the way they publicize things. Mm-hmm. You know, they're proud of their country, and they think that to point out those connections is going to attract people. I think it's probably not really. I think most Americans don't think that they need to join a club to be associated with Benjamin Franklin. But yeah, and I think this is also partly to do with the structure of Masonry today, in that the Freemasons who become Grand Masters typically don't have a great interest in philosophy or in esotericism. And if you want to talk about philosophy and esotericism, you may just want to go to a regular lodge, not to the Grand Lodge. Mm-hmm. It's not something that's promoted at all, that's for sure, if it's known about at the higher levels.
Okay, so that makes sense very much. I would agree with
what
you said there. What is your opinion about the, I guess, what are called more the philosophical or research lodges? Is the philosophy or the esoteric side of things held in more esteem there?
Right, yeah, good question. Generally, I think if you're in a large city, at least, you can definitely go to a regular lodge and find Masons that are perfectly happy to talk about philosophy and esotericism. In a small town in the Midwest, that may not be the case, but in a big city, you can definitely find it quite easily. The research lodges, they're definitely interested in history, and they almost certainly are interested in philosophy, and they take it all very, very seriously. And then if you become a member of the Societas Rosicruciana, then yes, the esotericism is really central. I mean, there would be no point in belonging to such a body if you weren't very interested in esotericism and alchemy and Christian mysticism and the Golden Dawn and related subjects. Yeah, and that really is its reason for existence. Absolutely.
Oh, fascinating. Okay. Now, please let me know if sort of overstepping or we're getting into areas that you don't want to discuss. But I'm curious because I'm friends with a number of Freemasons, and they are very much interested in the philosophical and esoteric side of things. But they themselves they would very much like to join the Societas Rosicruciana, but they do not know how to do so.
Yeah.
They're under the impression, from what I gather, in the sort of brief conversations that we've had about it, that it's something where they kind of hope to be tapped on the shoulder at some point. Is that correct?
Yes, that actually is correct, as far as I'm aware, you cannot apply to become a member of the Societas Rosicruciana. They have to ask you to become a member. The reason being, of course, it is serious and it is esoteric, and they don't want, you know, thousands of Masons joining just because they think it's yet another high degree and it makes them look impressive. They're generally speaking, they're only interested in people that have an interest in esotericism and philosophy, alchemy, etc.
That's very
So, giving advice to your friends, I would say probably to make that interest known, and obviously they could do something like give talks on the subject, and that would bring them into the right circles if they were going to give talks in lodges on esotericism, and then they would start to get in contact with the right people.
Okay. Well, I will definitely pass that along if they don't hear it directly from you in this recording. I'm sure that would be helpful to them. It's very, very interesting because it reminds me of the whole sort of idea of the original Invisible College, or where you had the Fama and the Confessio get published in Germany, and then you have people all over Europe who are trying to figure out how to join this society, and no one knows how to do it or who to contact.
Right. Yeah, that's correct. And I have to say, the Masonic Rosicrucian Society of today, I think, is pretty authentic in that regard, and it tries to be pretty traditional, and certainly it's not interested in making money or having expensive fees so they can buy things with it. I mean, it really is a serious sort of research society. Definitely, I think there's a relationship there.
Okay. Interesting. So in talking about Masonic Rosicrucianism, it sort of invokes another idea that's often encountered when researching Freemasonry, and that's this idea where you have, I guess, what are termed regular lodges, and then you have the idea of irregular lodges. Now, I'm not sure the people who are in the quote-unquote irregular lodges would call themselves that, but if you could sort of break it down in terms of what constitutes what is considered by most people regular Freemasonry, and then what is considered by the authoritative bodies to be irregular.
Right. Yeah, good question. And this is a subject that actually even a lot of Freemasons are unfamiliar with. There are different ways to be irregular or clandestine. Typically, lodges which are considered irregular and therefore regular Masons can't visit or associate with belong to another Grand Lodge which has done something that other Grand Lodges consider to be un-Masonic. So, for example, the Grand Orient, which is mostly in France and Italy, they discuss politics in their lodges, and they do not have to have a sacred book on the altar for initiation. So those things are considered to be un-Masonic. So they're considered irregular, and the Grand Lodges in America, for the most part, won't have any relationship with them. And then there are the other type of clandestine lodges, which would be more mystical. The OTO originally included references to Hiram Abiff, which is in the craft degrees, and I think at that point they were considered to be an irregular Masonic lodge, but that was removed, but there's no relationship there. But other lodges such as Memphis and Mithraim, if they confer the three craft degrees, then they can be considered to be irregular if they're doing things which are considered un-Masonic, if that makes sense.
Yes. Okay.
Or if they have a history which is considered questionable or illegitimate.
Interesting. Okay. Now, this when we look back in history, this idea sort of came to a conflict. I believe it was it 1782 at the Wilhelmsbad conference, where you had this the right of strict observance to strict Templar observance, where these were sort of neo-Templar Masons.
Yeah.
I forget the name of the baron who sort of founded this right.
Von Hunt.
Okay. That caused quite a stir within Freemasonry, and then this conference, they were decided to be irregular and no longer considered a valid right.
Yeah. Well, the issue of regularity is hotly debated among some Freemasons today. But during that period, it was for much more exciting reasons, in that when Freemasonry started to appear and gain real strength on the European continent from Britain mostly, it essentially decided that it didn't like being descended from the stonemasons, and that there must be some other origins which they were descended from, and this was invariably different knightly organizations, alchemists, Rosicrucians. So then essentially they created lots and lots of higher degrees which conferred alchemical secrets and Rosicrucian secrets, and made masons into knights and told them that it was all from the Knights Templar or from other knightly bodies. And some of them became very powerful, and the Strict Observance was the most powerful of all, probably, and that was a neo-Templar Masonic body, but very Templar. I think it had about 6 degrees, if I remember correctly. And then there were others, such as the Golden Rosicrucians, which you could become if you had taken the Scotch Master degree, which was 4th, and that was involved in... the Golden Rosicrucians were involved in alchemy and healing and seemed to have practiced even laboratory alchemy. And there was at one point over 1,000 different Masonic degrees being peddled on the European continent, and this became too much, and at that point they tried to decide which ones were legitimate and which ones were not, and the Strict Observance was decided not to be.
Okay. Now, I don't want to conflate this with the whole sort of furor over Illuminism, but was that occurring right around the same time period?
Do you mean the Illuminati, or...?
The Illuminati and various groups that subscribe to that doctrine, I guess you could say.
Well, the Illuminati was about the same period, actually, and the Golden Rosicrucians actually condemned the Illuminati, and they were sort of semi-Masonic in that they didn't really have Masonic ideals, but they did adopt some sort of Masonic ritualism for its own political purposes. But yes, the Golden Rosicrucians, surprisingly, did not like the Illuminati and actually openly attacked them.
Now, you mentioned them several times already, the Golden Rosicrucians. Now, let me just make sure I have this correct. They were essentially the forerunners of the Masonic Rosicrucian Society.
Yeah, in some ways, yeah. They were the earliest, most significant Masonic Rosicrucian Society, and they developed 9 different degrees, and that degree structure was taken over by the Societas Rosicruciana, and then eventually by the Golden Dawn and other groups. So that would be a definite influence, yeah, that's right. And there were other sort of forms of Masonic Rosicrucianism, and the Rose Croix degree, which is in the Scottish Rite today, that would be another form, and that was a very popular degree, and most Masonic rites, including ones that are considered irregular, they would have a Rose Croix degree yet today.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense.
Yeah.
Now, this idea of irregular masonry and the conflict between regular and irregular seems to have been brought out, at least in your research, when you wrote a bit about Aleister Crowley and his Masonic adventures or misadventures, if you want to call it that. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, he was initiated into the Scottish Rite in Mexico in the early 20th century, if memory serves me correctly. And then later, some years later, he tried to join a lodge under the, or at least to visit a lodge under the United Grand Lodge of England, which is the authoritative body in England, and was told that he was considered irregular because the Scottish Rite that he had joined, for whatever reason, was not recognized by them. Even though they actually do have a Scottish Rite degree system, that one wasn't considered regular. And then he joined a lodge in Paris, another Masonic lodge, and became a past master even, and then attempted again to visit the United Grand Lodge, and they again taught him that he wasn't considered to be regular. He joined all these other irregular bodies, mm-hmm. even though the rituals probably are not very different.
Right. Interesting. So, I find it very interesting because he then went on to join the OTO, which was, again, another irregular Masonic group.
Right, exactly. And I think originally, when you look at the early rituals, I mean, some of them are, for example, the early OTO Rose Choir, I don't know if it's changed, but the early OTO Rose Choir degree is almost identical to the Masonic one. There are a couple of significant differences, but almost identical. Very little difference. A sort of cursory reading, you'd probably think it was the same. And Aleister Crowley actually at one point, I think in his Confessions, says that refers to the OTO as Freemasonry. And in several places he refers to it as being Freemasonry, so that was definitely his conception.
It's interesting, you know, because I think from my research and talking to people, those who are involved at, I guess, what you would call irregular Freemasonry, in sort of their idea of Masonry is not necessarily the authentic body or Grand Lodge that empowers the group to do this work. It's more the idea that, they're using Masonic titles and degrees, but it's really a magical system to empower the initiate by means of activating, particular power points, they correspond with the particular degree ritual that they may be doing.
Right. Yeah, that's right. I mean, Freemasonry gets spoken of in different ways, and one is the sort of historical Masonic bodies, and then the other one obviously is a sort of idea, and I guess in the same way that one might speak of Christianity, one isn't necessarily speaking of a church, but some people might be, and other people might be talking about purely ideas or something else.
I think that's a very important point, yeah. That's excellent.
Indeed. But actually, Crowley, I should mention as well, actually belonged to some other different Masonic groups which were floating around, and one of them was the Rite of Memphis, which fed into the OTO. There's some Memphis degrees in there as well, revised.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now another topic I wanted to ask you about, and again, if you'd rather not discuss this, please let me know.
Okay.
It seems that over the course of time, periodically there is like an anti-Masonic movement or sentiment that seems to spring up, and I could be mistaken, but I get the sense that it oftentimes goes back to the exact same ideas and sources and accusations, like we had mentioned this the Taxil affair and Waite's book Devil Worship in France that details this whole controversy, basically pointing out that the whole accusation of devil worship is completely ridiculous in every respect that you want to examine it in. Whether it's outright satanic or Luciferian, it doesn't really make any difference because the people making the accusations are of questionable character at best, and the material that they're basing their accusations on is non-existent in most cases.
Right. Yeah, it's another complex, but definitely pertinent question. Yeah, there actually is more variation in accusations than that, but that certainly is one of them. And I think that the accusation that Freemasonry is somehow sinister in a sort of demonic sense has been taken over mostly by evangelical Christians today, the ones that care about this sort of thing anyway. But there are other reasons. The Nazis obviously persecuted the Freemasons. And they regarded it as Jewish, which is actually incredibly curious because before the Second World War, most German lodges would only accept Christians because they regarded Freemasonry as a purely Christian society, which has some basis in history. Early Freemasonry was Christian, and then because of their shufflings and reformings of Freemasonry, they had a very different version, and they were considered irregular for that reason. But but when the Nazis came to power, they considered it to be Jewish anyway. Obviously, they suspected many people for trivial reasons. Today, anti-Masonry is definitely still around and could well be significant in a few years. Hamas, I don't know if you know this, but Hamas in its charter condemns Freemasonry as well as the Lions and the Rotary Club, believe it or not, as Zionist agents. And there was actually a Masonic Grand Lodge attacked by a terrorist group, I think a few years ago, maybe around 2002 or 3, by Islamic militants in Turkey, and the part of the building was blown up, and a few people were shot. So, yeah.
That's amazing.
And actually, maybe I should just add as well, and in Britain, of all places, we really wouldn't suspect this, the government actually was pretty much persecuting Freemasons for about 10 years recently, up until about 2 or 3 years ago. And they were trying to get the police to register if they were Freemasons, and then the judges, and then pretty much anyone else that worked for the government, if they were Freemasons, they were trying to get them to have to register with some list, which is actually illegal under European law for obvious historical reasons. That's how it began in the Nazi period, after all. But eventually they had to drop it because it was illegal. So.
Right. And I know I get the sense that a lot of people who may not be, you know, evangelical Christians or you know, radical fundamentalists in any respect have anti-Masonic leanings simply because they feel like it's just another manifestation of what they would call like the old boys network, or
right,
just another club that people join to sort of look down on the rest of society, which I think, based on my experience and the people that I know, is definitely not the case.
Right, I have to say, from the Freemasons that I've met, it's definitely not the case as well. And, definitely not.
So, I mean, one of the things that always strikes me is, you know, this this idea of, you know, people who are Masons using their connections to either enrich themselves or better their position in society or whatever the case is. You know, I would ask anyone to, you know, point out an example to me of when that type of thing did not occur in human history, because whenever people get together in any kind of association, they're going to use those links, whether they are family or friends or associates, to try to better themselves. That's a natural human behavior, I think.
Yeah, although I think, it definitely is a natural human behavior. Although I think in Freemasonry's case, because Freemasonry has been attacked for this reason, probably for the last century at least, they tend to be very paranoid about this kind of behavior, and so it tends to be very difficult for people who become Masons to do that within Masonic lodges now. And I was speaking to a Mason in England a few years ago who told me that he was on a board of directors for some something, and then another Freemason called him and said, you would have had my vote, but then I found out you were a Freemason like me, so I can't vote for you now, because that would be unethical. So, yeah, so I think they're really almost paranoid about it now, especially in Britain, I would say.
Wow, so in fact, it's all because of the backlash, it's almost a reverse type of situation.
Right, in some cases, certainly. And yeah, and I have to say that I think Freemasonry as a whole has been very, very inept at dispelling this mythology, unfortunately.
Yeah, and that was one of the things I wanted to sort of bring into this part of the discussion is, do you believe that's just sort of an inept response, or that maybe that people have decided it's really not something that's even worth addressing head on, or it's one of those things that just kind of really not that, you know, the people just don't think that much about it who are, you know, when they're a member of the lodge.
Yeah, no, I think it's ineptitude mostly, unfortunately. Yeah, they have been really unable to explain what they do in a coherent, serious manner. For example, a few years ago, to dispel this mythology, the Grand Master in England said that Freemasonry was just like belonging to a golf club, which obviously raises many more questions than it answers. I mean, golf clubs don't have a supposed secrecy and rituals, so I think when you try and explain things in that manner, it becomes very suspicious, unfortunately. And no one has been able to put forth a good case for what Freemasonry really is. Although obviously now today there are, you know, different books appearing explaining what Freemasonry is, but it should come from lodges as well.
Yeah, I would agree. Another thing I'm curious about, and this is very, I don't even know if this is really quite on the subject, but are you familiar at all with the sort of the Greek fraternity system in American universities?
Very slightly. I'm from Britain originally, but I did live in America for quite a while, so I'm vaguely familiar with them, yes.
And the only reason I bring this up is because I could be mistaken, but I believe that, well, obviously the Greek fraternity sororities are structured based on a Masonic type of, very basic Masonic outline, I think.
Right.
But it strikes me that it serves the purpose to kind of introduce young people to not Masonry itself, but sort of the ideas of Masonry, the ritual, the ideals, the concepts and things to... So when people who have been through that encounter Freemasonry, it does not seem at all sinister or strange. It just seems like an extension of what they may have already experienced.
Right. Yeah, and I guess there's a couple of points to make there. And first of all, I mean, historically, Freemasonry was an enormous influence in America, especially because America or the USA was just finding its feet, just establishing itself really, and becoming the U.S. culture at the same time as Freemasonry was growing, and it spawned not only the Greek letter fraternities, but also even hundreds of little, not so little fraternities, which, having read many of their rituals, they're based almost exactly on Freemasonry, but often given some other sort of spin, and the Oddfellows would be a good example of that. But there are others in America, like the Junior Order of American Mechanics, I think it is, and that was a very big association at one point, and then the Knights of Pythias, and they were mostly for adults, and then obviously you have the Greek letter fraternities for students, and I think one of the reasons why it's so enormous in the English-speaking world, we don't really have in the last few hundred years maybe any sort of real initiation into manhood in a ceremonial sense that you might find in other cultures, but the primitive cultures or cultures that are still existing today, like the Jewish communities. And I think that the Masonic ritual has definitely offered a ceremonial step into manhood with all that implies, the step up philosophically, for example.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because that seems like a crucial thing. Obviously, the ancients felt it was, and the, you know, as you said, the manifestation of it today is still around, whether it is Freemasonry or whether you're talking about religious ceremonies that sort of confer that idea of crossing the threshold into adulthood. And
Right.
would be quite a tragedy to not have an organization or a system whereby people could experience that.
Right, exactly. And I think experience is the word, because, I mean, obviously you could read all of this old stuff in books, and you could you know, read ancient Greek philosophy and rational philosophy and Thomas Aquinas, and you could read about alchemy, and you could learn all of the things and more that you would find in a Masonic ritual or other rituals, like whether the Golden Dawn or the Order of Mechanics or whatever have you, but you don't have the experience, and that is the key, that you actually experience these ideas embodied around you. You know, everything in Freemasonry, the square and compasses, the level, the altar, the lodge itself all represent ideas. So you're not just getting to grips with these ideas, you're actually experiencing them.
Mm-hmm. And that, I guess, is one of the biggest keys of all. Is,
right, yeah.
It's actually going through it.
Yeah, that's right. And I think maybe in this day and age, this increasingly materialistic day and age, we tend to look at the world around us as a collection of objects that are valuable only in regard to their monetary value, or maybe if they exhibit some beauty or something. Whereas I think in Freemasonry and in traditional societies and in traditional Western society, even everyday objects exhibited some sort of idea and spiritual value.
Mm-hmm.
And to use one example, and it's a slightly comical example, the Victorians are well known today for covering up their table legs because they were considered to be terribly sexual if they didn't cover them up. But then if you look at Chinese culture today, and going back obviously into the ancient past, then the way that you put your chopsticks down could also suggest that you have to put them close together, because otherwise the two chopsticks could look sexual. So it's the same sort of thing. All of these everyday mundane objects are saying different things to you. And we've kind of lost that in the West and in modern society. And Freemasonry retains that. So the level which you're shown in the Masonic ritual, it represents that there is such a thing as a physical level, but then there's also the idea of the level being equality. So all these ideas are proved to you physically how they exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very important.
Yeah.
Before we run out of time, I want to ask you, because you know, we've been speaking for a little over an hour now. It's quite obvious that you're very well researched and well spoken, and know the material and the origins. And I've read excerpts from your upcoming book, Forest of Symbols. But for people who may be curious, would you mind explaining how your new book is different than, you know, all these other books on Freemasonry that they can find that are out there?
Right. Wow. Okay. Well, first of all, it does explore the early ritual, and I don't think any books actually do that. And it looks at the table lodge eating and drinking at the same time as the ritual, and looks at the very, very most primitive Masonic ritual. And it also looks at what that meant. And for example, it was very definitely based on the idea of natural law. Natural law being that human beings need to find out how they can improve themselves in a sort of natural way, although that's not exactly right. But and working in harmony with the things that are existing. So, for example, the planets are taken as embodying an intelligence because they exhibit some sort of regularity. And then human beings have to find out the same sort of a way of embodying this sort of universal cosmic intelligence, I guess. And growing, and this sort of unnatural law was embodied in not only in Greek philosophy, but in the early Masonic ritual, and then you find hints of it even in Aleister Crowley's Law of Thelema as well, the way he explains it as well. So it does look at the sort of philosophical basis and historical basis of the ritual, but then also goes on to show how this transformed into rituals of alchemy, rituals of Rosicrucianism and the Rosicrucian societies, and then how this ultimately affected and dramatically changed the Western esoteric traditions. So, for example, the Golden Dawn and the OTO, things like this.
Excellent. Yeah, and I very much am looking forward to the book. From what I've read so far and listening to your description of it, I believe this is definitely going to be a must read for students of the Western esoteric tradition, particularly those interested in Freemasonry. And I don't believe this is to be, you know, just another book on Freemasonry, like you hear, you know, said so many times about other people's works. So I'm very much looking forward to it. I would encourage people to check it out. Again, Forest of Symbols, Freemasonry, and the Western Esoteric Tradition, to be published by Ouroboros Press. And I believe that should be out very soon.
Yep, hopefully. A few months at the latest, I think.
Okay, excellent. Yeah. And your previous book, Freemasonry, A History, is already available?
Yeah, that was available a couple of years ago. And this one... it's out in a couple of months' time, hopefully. Yeah.
Excellent. And once again, your website can be found at www.angelmillar.com. That's ANGELMILLAR.com. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. And I had a very enjoyable time, and I think I learned quite a bit.
Oh, thank you. I had an enjoyable time as well. Thank you.
Excellent. I hope we can speak again in the future.
Oh, indeed, definitely.